Well, thanks, John, for queuing this up, and also to the organizers. I've learned a lot this morning, as I expect others here have as well, and I'm hoping to continue the trajectory here. My plan is to share some work with you that and some recent results from myself and colleagues at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, particularly with respect to our interest in growing cellulosic crops on marginal lands, and exploring both the potential for that and also some of the perhaps unintended consequences, the potential for unintended consequences, as we know, can be showstoppers in some cases. And as you'll see, this work has a lot of different contributors other than the three of us who put this talk together, and I'll acknowledge those towards the end. So we're all aware of the context, that is the short-term need for biomass production. The decadal goal is to replace 22% of transportation fuel by 2022 as legislated by ESA, which implies some 200 or so million metric tons of biomass. And that need can largely be met by low-hanging fruit, which is to say by forest product waste, by municipal waste, and of course as well as by stover and corn stover in particular. So we're probably likely to meet that need pretty readily in the next 10 years or so with these sources, but the long-term mid-century needs are a bit fuzzier and a lot more. And if we're thinking about replacing most of the transportation fuel used in light vehicles, we're talking about the need to produce somewhere around 650 million metric tons of biomass or so, which of course implies purpose-grown cellulosic crops. Now, we're also aware, most here, of the two major problems with purpose-grown cellulosic biofuels. The first, of course, is the food versus fuel problem, which is simply the ethics of growing fuel on land used for food. And the second is the issue of indirect land use cost. Indirect land use change attenuates the climate advantage simply by displaced food production creating carbon debt. And despite the extent to which you may think both of these problems are overstated, they certainly loom large in the public's eyes, and they also are very likely to become more intense as we move into a world that's more constrained by food availability. So we need to be thinking about solutions to getting around these problems in particular when we talk about a successful cellulosic biofuels industry. And one of those potential partial solutions is growing biofuels on marginal lands. Now, you know, the devil is in the detail with marginal lands, and how you define marginal lands matters a lot. As one of the a board member from the Iowa Farm Bureau once told me, your marginal land may be my homestead, so watch what you call it. But I think we can agree on some useful operational definitions, as Emily noted in her talk. We can think about marginal lands being arable land simply that's less suitable for food production, either land abandoned from agriculture because it's marginally or not profitable, or land that's environmentally vulnerable, that is to say it's not sustainable by most of our sustainability metrics. This would potentially avoid the food-fuel conflict and the ILUC effects, and we can see that there is a potential for marginal lands in the U.S., land that has been abandoned from agriculture for its being marginally productive. The shift out of U.S. cropland from 1950 to 2000 was assessed a few years ago by Dan Brown and colleagues and showed that there has been, since 1950 and between 1950 and 2000, an overall change of around 11% taken out of cropland during that period. So there is a potential for potential for using lands that have already been taken out of cropland to grow these cellulosic fuels. And then as we think about land as environmentally vulnerable, perhaps not sustainable, we can think about the CRP lands and the 10 million hectares or so that are currently in CRP, in part because they are environmentally vulnerable and are potentially available. So, of course, there are many more lands than are in CRP that are environmentally vulnerable, as we saw in Emily's talk, whereby perhaps taking land within a given field out of production could increase the amount of available land substantially as well. So these are potential solutions. That is to say, we may have some land available for this at a practical level, but there are two major questions with respect to this. One is there sufficient productive land to make it worthwhile? And the second is, are there unintended consequences? So the sufficient productive land means that it needs to be essentially non-cropped, non-grazed, non-urban, non-forested, non-parkland, and so on. That is to say, land that is currently not serving another environmental or productivity purpose, but yet is sufficiently productive to support nearby biorefineries. And then the next question becomes, were we to do this, are there unintended consequences for climate, reactive nitrogen loss, water use, and biodiversity? And all these questions are important to address as we think about building a sustainable cellulosic biofuels industry. So let's talk about the first question, and that is a question that we addressed last year in an analysis of the potential for marginal lands in the Midwest, a 10-state region, to produce a sufficient amount of biofuels to make it worthwhile to do so. And this work followed from our observation at KBS, at the Kellogg Biological Station in Southwest Michigan, that over 20 years, the development of productivity in a abandoned agricultural old field increased with the invasion, colonization by tall clonal species, Solidago canadensis in particular, which raised the productivity close to that as has been observed in on-farm switchgrass trials across the Midwest, somewhere on the order of 7 to 9 metric tons per hectare, especially when fertilized. And so we, Cesar Esmeralda's group in particular, in collaboration, developed a modeling exercise where across a 10-state Midwest region, we modeled the potential productivity of all lands that were classified as marginal by those criteria that I noted before in 50 by 50 meter pixels, in effect, across the area. And calculated the productivity for those for each one of those pixels, and then using a geospatial modeling framework, simulated the productivity and identified those areas that were, those pixels in effect, that were close enough to one another to provide enough fuel to, enough feedstock to feed a 30 million gallon biorefinery. And that's what these circles represent on this map, are those areas which are concentrated, have enough concentrated marginal land with productivity sufficient to provide that kind of feedstock. And the end result was we discovered that about 45% of the available marginal land in these 10 states could meet about 25% of the ESA mandate for 2022, suggesting that, in fact, these marginal lands, as are currently embodied in the current current databases, could in fact produce a significant amount of cellulosic biofuel without food fuel competition or indirect land use costs. Now, this is an analysis that assumed that these crops were well established. That is to say, there was no conversion cost, carbon debt created by the conversion of these lands. And we know that's pretty important when we think about creating these systems. So over a we've done a number of greenhouse gas balances in the cropping systems at the Kellogg Biological Station and some of our well-equilibrated systems, and tabulated the net sources and the net sinks of greenhouse gases for a variety of different cropping systems along an annual to perennial gradient. So the annual systems are corn, soybean, wheat rotations, of perennial or alfalfa and poplar trees, and a successional system to those systems that are simply abandoned farmland. And we added to this analysis the potential carbon offset, CO2 offset gained by using the produced biomass for ethanol production. And as you can see, the costs are, you know, differ quite a bit across here, depending on whether it's whether the cost is nitrous oxide emission, agronomic inputs, but the benefits, the bottom part of these graphs are also quite substantial. This is the net difference across these different systems, and as you can see, the successional systems had a pretty substantial benefit over the other systems, largely because of the lack of inputs. These are simply systems that are let go, except for the 50 kilograms of nitrogen that are added to this last bar here. So the long-term climate consequences of these systems are quite positive, but again, these are well-established systems, and there's an issue with respect to the conversion costs. And we know those conversion costs can be quite substantial. When we converted a former CRP lands, a field of about 25 hectares, to switchgrass, we found that in the first year of production, we could create, largely because of CO2 release, but also N2O release, even converting these into no-till systems, we created almost 68 megagrams of CO2 debt per hectare. And so the debt created on these converted lands are quite substantial and can take up to 29 to 50 years to repay, compared to the reference site, which is essentially the old field that was let go. And converting with tillage, of course, just simply exacerbates this problem. If we look at a conventional till versus no-till breakout of the CRP land, we find that there is almost a fourfold difference in the carbon debt created when one tills the soil, even a single tillage event, which lost effectively 8 years of carbon accumulation under the no-till. And importantly and interestingly, the nitrous oxide flux was almost half of the carbon debt that was created on that conversion. So conversion matters and tillage matters hugely. There are also potential unintended consequences for reactive nitrogen loss. In a fertilizer response gradient for switchgrass, we found that during establishment, the switchgrass is differentially responsive to nitrogen input. So the first harvest year, the second year of establishment, it was responsive to about I can't read these numbers, but this is about 150 kilograms of nitrogen. The second year was responsive to about 56 kilograms of nitrogen, and the third year responsive only to about 20 kilograms of nitrogen. And this simply points out the sensitivity of these different systems to nitrogen fertilization. And the importance here comes when one considers the sensitivity with which nitrous oxide and nitrate respond to these gradients. So the nitrous oxide response, there. At the low end of the fertilization curve down here, there's not a whole lot of nitrous oxide being produced. But as you exceed the crop need, we find, and we've now seen this globally, the response of nitrous oxide to fertilizer takes an exponential shape. So a little bit of over-fertilization past the point at which the crop is taking up nitrogen matters a whole lot. And likewise for nitrate loss as well. Water use is another issue that we have to be concerned about when we think about the unintended consequences of these systems. And Kurt Thalen described a bioenergy cropping system experiment earlier this morning that we have established in Wisconsin and Michigan, where we have a series of different systems ranging from continuous corn to restored prairie along a diversity gradient. And we're monitoring a number of attributes along this gradient, including water use. And I mainly want to concentrate on this upper graph. This is precipitation in millimeters of water, and you can see the drought year of 2012 here. This is 2010, 11, and 12, and 13. These four bars across here. And the first set of bars is corn water use, corn system water use. The second is switchgrass, and the third is miscanthus. And the remarkable part of this chart is that the water use doesn't differ a lot among these different systems. Now, water use efficiency varies a lot because production is quite different. So water use efficiency is quite different among these different systems, but water use itself is not, which suggests that, importantly, that cellulosic biofuels are no more water use intensive than corn, at least at the systems level here, in this mesic environment. And then finally, there are potential biodiversity effects that we have to be aware of. And this is a work that has been led by Doug Landis and Claudio Graton's groups, in which across some 60 sites across Michigan and Wisconsin, a third of which were in corn, a third of which were in switchgrass, and a third of which were in restored prairie, with fields ranging from 10 to 100 hectares in size, monitored or observed the changes in biodiversity across these different systems, and microbes, and particularly within and methanotrophs, arthropod herbivores, arthropod predators, pollinators, and breeding birds, and perhaps not surprisingly, saw major differences between the corn and the perennial systems with respect to all of these taxa, which had functional significance. Now, the interesting thing here, though, is that while the grasslands versus maize showed the biggest differences here, both for the diversity of these taxa as well as for the function, which includes methane consumption, pest egg removal, pollination, grassland bird sightings, and aphid pressure, were positive both for the taxa and for the functional significance of this, there wasn't much difference between the prairie versus the switchgrass. Now, granted, these switchgrass were not pure switchgrass, but nevertheless, it was significant that there were no significant differences among the prairie and switchgrass, suggesting that it doesn't take a lot of diversity to get a lot of biodiversity benefits from these systems. And so we can think about ways to insert biodiversity into these cellulosic cropping systems, perhaps without a lot of a lot of need to establish multiple or large multiple of species assemblages. So let me conclude with a few observations here. One is that marginal lands do, in fact, offer significant potential for providing a reasonable amount of cellulosic biomass. How much awaits further analysis? Especially as we think about the potential for marginally productive land, as opposed to land that's already been abandoned, being brought into the domain of potential biofuel areas. And secondly, that the risk of unintended consequences is real. Establishment can produce substantial carbon debt, and unmindful fertilizer use will undermine, perhaps by some of our research is showing that nitrogen use alone can undermine about a third to a half of the climate benefit of switchgrass crops, for example. Water use, on the other hand, may be similar to annual crops, and so that's a positive finding. And biodiversity can be encouraged with the right crops, and again, it doesn't seem to take a lot of biodiversity in the crops to produce a lot of functional biodiversity in the landscape. And these first two risks present, I think, particularly interesting agronomic challenges, because establishment can produce substantial carbon debt, but are there ways to establish these crops? I mean, we used, in our analysis in Nature last year, we used the successional vegetation that was already there to assess the potential cellulosic biofuel feedstock potential, but certainly we should think about planting those areas to some improved feedstock, such as switchgrass. But can we do that without producing carbon debt? And that, to me, is an agronomic problem, not a biogeochemical problem. And then likewise, unmindful fertilizer use is another agronomic problem. Can we better predict the need for fertilizer, and can we add it in a way that doesn't lead to both climate as well as water quality issues? And certainly managing for multiple ecosystem services at the local and landscape scale is going to be key to the success of any future industry. So thank you very much.